We're going to do something that I've done before, but haven't done in a while here. We're going to do a little bit of reaction, and we'll see how it goes. We'll do a little bit of reaction, and I want to do a little bit of maybe a little poetry reading from The New Yorker here. We'll see. But I thought about doing this, and I thought I could get it done last week, but I couldn't. Go figure. But thanks to all the listeners and subscribers out there who have stuck with me for this. I appreciate it, and hopefully I will make it up to you here by putting out great episodes to come in the future. But I also wanted to just say to regular listeners here, and also, you know, regular listeners and subscribers to the show, that there will be some changes to the show going forward. And I don't mean that in terms of, you know, a negative thing. I was getting sick of interviewing a lot of, you know, glamour projects and things like that. And I just decided, I'm like, you know, I have to just make a stand here and just not say yes to a lot of these offers that I'm getting now for interviews for writers that I've never heard of. And, you know, those conversations are usually great, and usually we find something great to talk about. But I don't know, I just felt that it was, that the decisions, even though I know it's still my decision, the decisions were not my own, that they were being prompted to me. And I was just like, oh, sure, yeah, you know. But then I realized I was kind of losing the direction of what I wanted and what I was originally trying to do with the show. So, you know, that's all I have to say. That's the change. So again, you know, not a big change as far as that goes, but just wanted to keep you guys updated, and then we'll see how it goes here. But I thought I'd do a little reacting, because, well, I saw a few things. This is a few weeks old now. April 5th, 2026. But Ben Lerner was doing the rounds for a promotion of his newest book, Transcription, which is linked below, listeners. And those of you who listened to me before know I've covered some of Ben Lerner's stuff. And I don't have much against Ben Lerner. You know, nothing like that. I just, you know, my pet peeve is when people start saying like woo-woo stuff about the magic of writing and things. And I just, you know, well, we'll get into it here. I'm going to go into this interview. We're going to do some reaction to this interview, and I'll read it out. It's always interesting, you know, you see everybody react to this stuff, and so few people actually read it. You know, everybody's reacting to one little fragment. Who knows? But Lerner is interviewed in The New Yorker here a couple weeks ago while he's doing kind of a, you know, what they call a book tour now for his latest book. And he's interviewed by Andrew Marantz? I don't know. Who knows who they have working at The New Yorker nowadays? But we'll just start. There's all this introduction, blah, blah, blah. We're going to skip right to the interview. Oh man, this is already... I want to be able to speak freely, and I want you to be able to speak freely. And in order to do that, I think you should have more freedom than usual to take stuff off the record. My journalistic ethics justification is that, because we know each other, I don't want to take something that you told me privately and inadvertently drag it on record if you wanted to stay private. Lerner's answer. You can ask me anything. I feel totally at ease. Sorry that I'm stupid. It could be the cumulative effects of COVID, I've decided, and cardiac bypass, and stupefaction of the far right. So there we go. I mean, that's not even really a question. It's kind of a disclosure, I guess. But already have the far right mentioned. Again, I don't understand why the far right is preoccupying so many people's minds. But I guess it's just casually mentioned. As well as his cardiac bypass, whatever, you know. Oh, he's stupid for saying what he thinks. Because again, what's implied by that, listeners? What's implied by the, oh, I'm stupid. I'm stupid because I feel totally at ease answering interview questions. Something that's been the norm for hundreds of years. Why do you think that is? Well, we know why. We know why. Listeners to this know why. Because you're not allowed to say what you think. Especially if you're a straight white man. Like Lerner. And the interviewer says, and screens, you also have to blame screens. Yes, right, screens. I forgot about the screens. Oh, fucking screens. Okay, so I'll turn this on. Turns on audio recorder. Has that recorder been used when you've been embedded with the far right? Am I getting the chance to share the hardware with the... Yeah, this hardware has been enchanted by a multitude of voices. Oh, I guess this journalist embedded himself with the far right. Whatever that means. Oh my god. This is... I'm gonna have to skip over some of this, guys. Sorry. I mean, it's just... Oh man. Your new book, obviously, is about interviewing. When I read it, my first thought was, poor Ben, he's going to have to sit through a really annoying publicity tour where all these interviewers say, I'm interviewing you about a book about interviewing. Isn't that clever? Then later I thought, but if I were to interview Ben about his book about interviewing, that would be really clever. Jesus Christ. Sorry, I should have skipped that entire thing. For example, the theme of superposition. Put very simply, the idea that characters exist in a number of potential states simultaneously, and this ambiguity or multiplicity doesn't get resolved until some point in the future, which is also a way to think about what we're doing now, talking to each other in the present, but in a way, that only really makes sense if there's an audience in the future. So I want to talk about what the interviewing does in the book, but first, can you lay out its premise? Okay, we're skipping this question, guys. I don't care. The next question. The book is very interested in questions about the role of technology versus the role of the artist. It's also noticing how phones are distracting and enervating, which is, on its face, a very familiar observation. Lerner's answer is right. There wasn't a book in me that was merely about showing how our attention is degraded by our phones. The book became writable when I thought of its project as partly about restoring our wonder before the weird fact of the disembodied voice that is made possible by different media. Like voicemail and radio. I was interested in that seance like new old ancient but very contemporary charging of the air around us. You're right that there is a risk of being merely diagnostic when you write about things like cell phones. What fascinates me is the idea of making it seem like more of an ancient, dangerous human capacity to sever the voice from the body. I mean, you know, I don't know about all that. But I guess, you know, the answer's fine. I don't have anything wrong, you know, whatever, if that's what is his motivation for writing about phones. And I mean, we've talked about writing about phones on this show. I mean, writing about phones and the internet and how that comes into it is a challenge and how you're going to use that. But, you know, man, this is already really uninteresting. I'm sorry, guys. Can you say more about what you mean by one person talking through another? Man, this is a New Yorker. Interview question. One person talking through another. Lerner says, I was interested in questions like, how does your mother's or father's voice get in your voice? How does your debate coach, the music you're listening to on the radio, the bankrupt contemporary political speech that's circulating around you, inflect your voice? Adam Gordon, the book's protagonist, is always passing off someone else's language as his own. I've also been thinking about how many of the voices that I know and that are in my head, the voices of writers, artists, relatives, etc., are actually fictions produced by different strategies of transcription. For example, one of the things that went into the writing of this novel was my experience interviewing the great poet. I'm reading this too because I'm I wanted to react to this in real time, so I didn't read it. And I'm just reading through now, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ. So anyway, I did this one for the Paris Review, and the way the review does it, they're heavily edited, but are even blah, blah, blah. You cut down a lot of tape in a relatively pithy exchange. The result is a document that has its own authenticity, but is by no means a transcription of the actual conversation that took place. Okay. The review did a great job. It was disorienting to have had these conversations, and then to see that what was going to be transmitted was real in its way, but not a transcription of the experience I had. Fiction in that regard. Yeah, you know, there's the thing with Lerner, and again, I've got nothing against the guy other than the fact that I think he says some pretty vapid things. You know, the idea that an interview you do with a prestigious outlet is edited down is some type of disorienting or surreal experience, that it was a fictional conversation because it was edited down, is just really, really low grade thinking. I think really elementary level dissection of what took place and what transcription of the actual conversation would mean or something. I don't know. I just think it's a lot of hot air, you know. And then, of course, this great follow-up question by Andrew Marantz. Do you recognize your own voice in interviews? What a fucking follow-up question. Oh, wow, what an interesting thing to ask. I tend not to look at interviews that I do after the fact. If I do, I don't really recognize myself. Oh, man, these are so boring. Okay, we're skipping over this. Okay, next question is, one character says to the narrator something like, maybe on some level you wanted to fail to record your last interview so that you could protect yourself from losing this person because the recording would be too definitive. Lerner says, yeah, I think that's right. This is not something that the book gets into, really, but I know you're thinking a lot about AI. We're in a moment where the replication of the voice is totally possible. It takes, what, I think, 3 seconds of an audio clip to be able to generate audio in a person's voice. I do think that blah, blah, blah is frightening, but also makes me wonder, well, what are the special powers of the comparatively low-tech, but nevertheless technological way of registering a voice that is the sentence or the line of poetry or novelistic dialogue? I know everybody's talking about AI for this, but frankly, I don't even really care. I think AI is much more primitive than people are letting on in terms of being able to write novels or something, but who knows? I mean, and then the special powers of the comparatively low tech. I mean, you know, I get what he's saying here. And I do appreciate that, like, he's aiming at something that I think is real, you know, the comparatively low-tech, but nevertheless technological way of registering a voice, you know, within the brain, a line of poetry, you know, novelistic dialogue, what is in that that makes it special versus kind of an imitation or an AI creation, right? Well, that's the question, right? Some people call it soul, spirit, magic. Who knows? Oh, and we got magic in the next question here. Here we go. Next question by Andrew Marantz. You've said that, like all poets, you believe in the magical power of words, but you also recognize that their power has limits. This is kind of an aside, says Lerner, but I'm remembering a Trump rally in the summer of 2016, when the implication of what he said was clearly that someone would take Hillary Clinton out if she came after the guns. Now, that wouldn't even count as a scandal, but it was a scandal at the time. And Trump said something like, look at the transcript. I never said that. And it was true. I mean, this is kind of the definition of the dog whistle, I guess, back when we still had dog whistles. Laughter. But there is this way that affect and intonation and implication, those things are precisely what wouldn't show up in a transcript. So it's interesting to think about what part of politics is that which escapes transcription, that escapes that kind of record. Yeah, I mean, I guess interesting point. But I mean, how else are you supposed to fucking respond to a question about the magical power of words? I mean, I guess you don't have to go Trump rally. But, whatever, you know. Whatever. Alright. I mean, everything's about Trump nowadays. I didn't realize. I never really read The New Yorker anymore. But again, I know how much people talk about the Trump admin, but I mean, it's clearly like you can't even talk about a book being promoted by somebody like Ben Lerner without this. I mean, Lerner brought it up himself, I guess. So here it is. Constantly invoked. The next question is, this is one of the many underappreciated aptitudes of Trump's art form. He's incredibly good at leaving things out of the transcript, which, as you've pointed out, makes him a kind of poet. Your poem, The Circuit, starts with a few lines that are just quoting Trump verbatim. You quote Reagan in 1004 and Bob Dole in the Topeka School. When you were working on this new book, did you think at all about whether it would be more or less political in an overt sense than those previous books? Again, what a question. Like, this is the caliber of interview for The New Yorker. All right. All right, boys and girls. Did you think your book would be political? Jesus Christ. Well, this book is much quieter, Lerner says. I wanted to write a book that explains very little and makes a lot felt. Political situations, especially in relation to COVID, are around the edges of the book. And the questions about why these children are in these deep protests against contemporary life, refusing to go to school, refusing to eat, are inseparable from their inability to imagine a future. Thomas's character is also a way of posing questions about the relationship between politics and media now. I mean, he says his earliest childhood memory is hearing Hitler's voice on the radio. I don't understand. I don't understand what that means. One dichotomy that's set up in the book is between the language of poetry and the language of law. Thomas, an artist and a critic, keeps saying, why do we have to be so literal? We speak in the language of literature, not the language of law. Max, his son, is a lawyer, so he wants the real. One way to understand that conflict is to say, no matter how close we try to get to the real, it's always mediated. Is there a question in that? Doesn't seem so. But Lerner's response to it is, for me, as a fiction writer, dialogue has always felt like the most potentially embarrassing moment of any work, because it's the moment where there's a maximal bid for realism. It's supposed to be mimetic of speech, but if everyone speaks in perfectly grammatical sentences, it's not realistic. And if you actually try to register the fragmentation and cacophony of speech, if you try to be a recording device in that literal sense, the signal can be lost in the noise. At best, you have sound art. The degree to which dialogue seems to require cleaning up speech or letting it dissolve into a complicated soundscape, trying to get the level of mediation right, that's a central novelistic problem that I've always been interested in. I just, again, these are elementary school questions. I don't understand this. No matter how close we try to get to the real, it's always mediated. What? What the fuck is the real? We're talking about fiction. This is what pisses me off when people say honestly, or honesty in literature. I mean, Lerner answers this in a response that, I mean, I don't even think his response is bad. I mean, I agree with it. I think it's a little over-intellectualized, but, you know, whatever. It's a fine answer. Fine thing to be interested in for a novelist, you know. What can you say, right? This interviewer sucks, by the way. How the fuck do I get an interview with The New Yorker? Doesn't seem that hard. You once published a long prose poem called The Media. Thomas is a media scholar, a multimedia artist, and also a kind of medium. Can you say more about the preoccupation with media, with mediation? Jesus Christ, what a follow-up question. This guy. Somebody needs to send this guy to journalism school. Holy shit. Learner's response. I mean, all of my books, and many of the books I love, involve staging encounters with media, whether that media be a painting or a poem or a phone. And leaving the Atocha station, payphones are really important. The narrator has an important conversation with his mother on a payphone. There's also a scene where a woman recounts talking on a payphone when she was in New York City and feeling the reality of her father's death hit her in a different way, precisely because she could feel her distance from Spain and where she's from so acutely. For me, one of the most memorable moments in Proust is when the narrator first hears his grandmother's voice on the phone. Alright, I'm sorry guys, there's just... I'm gonna skip this next one too. Next one, I'm skipping around because this interview's boring the shit out of me. Okay, I don't know if it'll be read this way, but I do think this is centrally a book about parenting. And it seems to me that the things that make Thomas worse as a father are the things that make him better as an artist. Max says something about how you don't want a spirit medium for a father, Lerner says. The inexhaustible fecundity of Thomas's mind, that kind of associative logic and the way that he takes over conversations and brings them to these wild domains, is exactly what Max doesn't need around the death of his mom, for example. God, this is so fucking annoying. Alright, here we go. You brought up AI before, and I'd like to hear you talk specifically about AI and what it's doing to writing, to poetry, to fiction, to the sentence. But it's interesting, when I think of AI, I often think of it in terms of the written word, but you brought it up in terms of the voice. Lerner says, a few years ago, my brother left me an AI-generated voicemail in my own voice. It just said, hey Ben, this is your brother, I just want you to know what this new technology can do. Imagine if I called mom and asked for your social security number. And he left one in Spanish, one in Hindi, and one in Mandarin, and it was, well, it was horrifying. But I do also think that every time there's this radical extension of the ability to capture or reproduce the voice or the image, etc., it creates an interesting counterpressure on the arts it supposedly renders obsolete. What can your art do that isn't totally supplanted by this other technology? Well, one thing is that when a human transcribes a human voice, the two voices interact in unpredictable ways, and all of this can be beautiful. All this registers the texture of the lived, of duration. Transmission isn't just about... Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. That's a good answer. I think one response to this is just to get really interested in the specific social conditions of the transmission of the human. Okay. Maybe not that part I agree with. There's... Lerner goes on. There's a way in which you bypass part of the problem of AI. And writing, if you're interested in writing, that was done by humans, like me... I'm just actually interested in how the bodies and voices of the dead were transferred to the page and the moment of inscription and what it means for me to receive that. Oh, shut up. What if we cross the singularity of being able to know for sure? Oh, Jesus. This interviewer is retarded. Andrew Manorats, or whatever his name is retarded. I think we already have, Lerner says, but I think the Turing test isn't the right way of thinking about literature because it's also possible to just say, I want to be a part of a human community. I want to know the things I'm reading are written by a human. I don't think anybody here has read an AI book. You should try and read an AI-written book. Like, it's so obvious. Like, I mean, so obviously, you have to be retarded to not know it's AI. But I think what Lerner's saying here is true also. He's saying it this really dumb way about the humans. Humans. Written by a human. Because I value the channel open between the compositional moment and the moment which I'm reading. And I think he's right about that, but of course I wouldn't put it that way. But he's talking about that feeling you get from... some work of art, that exchange of emotion from hundreds of years ago, you can still get it. That is what makes the difference between AI and human art. Okay, I think I'm done with this interview, guys. I really don't care. Alright. I'm gonna click on the fiction and poetry. Alright. Let's go to the poetry. Alright, let's read this poem here. Spring comes and I finally throw out the last flowers I bought you by Ariel Francisco. April 20th, 2026. Actually, it looks like I'm not going to do that because it's paywalled me out of that New Yorker.
Heavy.
Bored.
Heavy.
I am heavy, heavy,
heavy
bored.
Sweats and the day sweats, pal, I do.
If you're hearing this, it's because you are listening to the free public feed of Heavy Board. To get complete, uncensored, uninterrupted, full access to this podcast, become a subscriber at patreon.com/heavyboard. That's right, Heavy Board is made possible by subscribers like you. For less than one cup of coffee per month, you will receive private access to uncensored, full-length episodes, Jerk Shop, heavy bonus content, subscribers-only AMA episodes, bonus extended interviews, and more. Come join the conversation today at patreon.com/heavyboard.